Welcome to the Wilderness Medic Podcast. Check out our website at www.thewildernessmedic.com.
Expedition resources, Wilderness Medicine blog, and much more.
Hello and welcome to the Wilderness Medic Podcast. My name is Daniel, and today I'm really excited to be joined by Dr. Chris Turner, who is an emergency medicine consultant, and he works in the West Midlands. And as well as that work, he has set up the organisation Civility Saves Lives, which is what we're going to talk about today. And he set this up to essentially spread the message about the importance of kindness and being a nice person within medicine, which seems on the surface of it to be something that's quite obvious. But it's not always that easy to practice. And so we're going to sort of investigate some of those themes and ideas today. So welcome, Chris.
Hiya, Dan. It's absolutely fantastic to meet you. I'm laughing there. The idea that Civility Saves Lives is an organization, it's a kind of amorphous blob that people from all around the world use in any way that they see fit. And do you know when you were introducing me there, You use the N word, nice. And I thought, oh, good grief, there'll be a whole bunch of people who have just been reaching for the stop button, you know, being nice in medicine. And they'll be screaming, don't you know what I have to deal with every day?
That's
being
it, isn't
nice.
It?
Yeah. Huh. It's like the GMC just said that that in their next iteration of guidance on sort of good professional standards, they're going to be talking about doctors being kind. And that's a completely fascinating thing when your regulator starts to say that you have to be kind or you have to be nice, when the job demands something different some of the time. But anyway, we might get into that.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, isn't it? And it's something we'll unpick later. But yeah, some of these things that we can talk about when we're not at work seems sort of obvious, but then it's putting them into practice at times, isn't it? So I guess to start with it'd be interesting just to hear about why you started, I won't call it an organization, but why did you start Civility Save Lives? What sort of things had you identified and kind of what prompted you to set it up?
Okay, so basically we started, this is Joe Farmer and myself, we started Civility Saves Lives over a coffee when we were just talking about something that Joe might be able to give a talk about. And we were bouncing around between different ideas. And eventually, what happened was that we drifted off. We drifted off into a different topic. And we started talking about something that had happened in his workplace. He'd been on call with a registrar. He was, at the time, was an F1. On call with a registrar that was awesome. You know that doctor that you just completely can rely on. She knew her way around everything. She navigated the system. She helped people. And she was diagnostically and therapeutically excellent. And he really liked her. And this was a surgical specialty. And one evening, they ended up in theatre. And it was an on-call thing. And they were in there with a consultant that... I'm not sure if they knew the consultant or not. Anyway, what happened was the operation started, and Jo had been in operations with her previously, and she'd been great. And then, for some reason, the consultant seemed to start to nitpick and nip and nip and nip and be more and more overtly critical of the registrar's performance. And Jo said he watched. He watched as somebody he knew to be competent, somebody he knew to actually be excellent, went from being that potentially excellent person to somebody who was competent, then barely competent, and eventually didn't have any competency, and the consultant took over. And we were talking about this, and I was saying to him that at the time there'd just been started to be some evidence that this is a real thing. This happens to us. We can take competent individuals and we can enhance them. We can help them to be even better, but we can also diminish them and we can leave them as being incompetent people. in the moment, but that's enough. And we were talking about how it was behavior that seemed to drive that. It's our relationship with each other has a demonstrable, measurable impact on our ability to perform. And that was what he'd watched. And we thought, well, we'll give a talk about that. And we thought, we'll give the talk a strapline because things are, mm-hmm. People like a wee message that comes with it. And actually, we thought about loads of stuff. We thought about civility saves lives early on. The reason we used civility, and civility wasn't a particularly commonly used word in healthcare at that moment in time. The reason we used it is that's the word that was being bandied about in the literature. People like Christine Porath were using the word civility. Amir Erez was using it. Bob Sutton refers to it and thought, yeah, do you know what? That's probably a good word. But then people told us that folk wouldn't know what civility meant and that we should go for something a bit more hard-hitting. Turns out what people mean by hard-hitting is something that is a little bit more negative, and it's don't be a. So instead of civility saves lives, they were suggesting don't be a. And actually, you can choose any primary or secondary sexual characteristic and any word that you might use for that, and you don't be a, shove that word on the end of that, and people go, yeah, that's the message. That's what you want to send. But there's a problem with that. None of us see that as being ourselves, certainly not regularly. So saying to me, don't be an ass. There's the gentlest version of this I can think of. Saying that to me, I'm going, well, I'm not. I tell you why I'm not if you said that to me. And actually,
that can also make you become defensive and then cause a worsening spiral of what you're trying to prevent.
Yeah, because I'm going to prove to you why I'm not. So we went for something pro-social, and we did that really very specifically because we'd just become aware of Learning from Excellence, which was Adrian and Emma Plunkett's pro-social looking at the positive things in healthcare and trying to replicate them. That the Learning from Excellence movement was just beginning its baby steps. And we thought, you know what? This is right. This is the way to do it. Because we shouldn't be telling people what not to be. We should be saying, what does good look like? And we thought, civility saves lives. Well, that's what we go to work to do. So let's go with that. And wrapping this thing that we talk about up in a social pro-social message has allowed people to get on board with it who otherwise would have felt that we were pointing a finger at them. Some people still think we're pointing a finger at them, and I'm really not. And I don't think the other guys are either. But that's how Civility Saves Lives came about. So Joe and I over coffee, and it was going to be one talk. We obviously spent a long time thinking of the branding of this for one talk, but, you know, sometimes that can be really helpful. And thought it would be one talk. And after that one talk, that I did one talk, Joe did one talk, and both of us got asked to do other stuff. So I went back and did another, and another, and another. And then this started to gain momentum. Then I did a couple of TEDx talks. There's one of them you can see on TEDx Exeter, Chris Turner. You'd see me doing a TEDx talk on this. And from there, it kind of snowballed. It turns out that people really were open to this message. And that rather than looking at sort of more and more and more technical mastery, people wanted to think about how we function with each other and what impact that might have. And if we really want to have fantastic teams, you know, what does behavior add to that? Turns out it adds an awful lot.
Yeah, it's really interesting, you know, that snowball effect. I guess it sort of illustrates that everyone, I mean, through the nature of life, has experienced people being uncivil and sadly probably at work as well. I guess in terms of civility, you mentioned, obviously, I said nice at the beginning. You know, you can have other things as well. But how do you sort of define being civil? How do you become a civil person when, you know, a lot of the time it is the system that is that fault, you know, and it's difficult, isn't it?
I mean, anybody who says it takes, you know, it costs nothing. I mean, frankly, that's rubbish. It is effortful to be civil with people. And a word that I would use synonymously with being civil is respectful. And I think that works quite well most of the time. None of the words work perfectly, but respectful works pretty well for me most of the time. And it can be extremely difficult to be respectful to somebody who you think is just completely wrong and pushing an agenda with you. It can be extremely difficult to be respectful to somebody when you are under incredible personal pressure. So one of the things about this is it is effortful. It's, you know, it's not for nothing. It's recognizing that in a given situation, I might not be the best version of myself, and I have to display some self-control. I have to decide what it is that I want to be achieving here. And one of the things I often end up talking about is, do I want to be right, or do I want to do the right thing? Because an awful lot of the time, when I am getting into conflict with people, I realize that what I'm trying to do is be right. I want to be right. When, if I'm dealing with somebody else who sees the world through a different lens, then actually, I can't see it through their lens. And what I want is to know how they see the world. Letting it slip into a zero-sum game of I'm right and you're wrong is absolutely unhelpful. So for me, a large chunk of this is about remembering that I'm consciously trying to be respectful to people, and that the reason I'm being respectful to them is because they're not trying to do the wrong thing. They're trying to do the right thing from their perspective. And the only way I can understand that is if they tell me their perspective. And then I can incorporate that into my way of thinking.
That's really interesting, really valuable. And I guess similar when you... It doesn't just have to be colleagues. That's a very good approach for talking with patients when they're maybe agitated or they have a different agenda to yourself as a clinician. I think trying to dig down, and obviously sometimes this approach might not work, but a lot of the time if you listen and just try and understand, as you're saying, where someone's kind of paradigms are, because they can be completely different from yours, can't they? I think that can make a huge... And it seems like a relatively simple concept, doesn't it, on that face value? But I guess, you know, the fact that we've all sort of experienced people being rude or arseholes or whatever we want to call them means that in practice it is difficult. I mean, what do you think the main barriers are? Do you think it is just pressure, stress, not being able to sort of have that self-awareness or that bandwidth and things like that? And how can we get better at doing this?
All right. So just to go back, we'll come on to that. We'll come on to the barriers in a second. You said this is pretty simple. One of the other words that people sometimes use is basic. They say, come on, this is basics. And I think it's true. It's basic. But I think basic has a problem. When we say to people, this is basic, we assume that we know the basics. Actually, I think a better way of thinking about this is it's the fundamental of communication in complicated and complex situations. That is to say, ones where we can't see all the angles.
Yeah.
And the fundamental there is holding a conversation where we are seeking to understand. And there are loads of barriers to this. You would imagine that, you know, I say it and I think, you know, come on, we hold a conversation to understand, that can be that difficult. Except the big barrier here, well, it's a few barriers, but one of them is time. If you don't have the time to engage with somebody and to be present with them and to make them feel respected, then what happens is that you start to sort of drive the conversation, particularly if you're coming from a position of authority. So I'm a consultant in emergency medicine in Coventry. And if I'm talking to a patient, I know that there's another massive big queue of patients around the corner who need somebody to go and speak to them, and I have that, the weight of that on my shoulders, and I start asking a patient a question. I might start with an open question, and we know that pretty quickly doctors interrupt, and, you know, at varying points in the past we've looked to this, and it's been 18 seconds. 18 seconds is quite good. It's been 11 seconds on average when people have interrupted.
Yeah.
At one point, it went out into the 30s. But the truth is that we feel this weight, and people say, well, if you just let the patient talk, you would get all the information you want. But it's not just about that. It's about getting the information in the order that I need it so that I can make sense of it in a way that makes sense in my head. And that pressure to get that information creates a barrier, and we start banging questions in. The other thing that creates a barrier is when we are literally overloaded, when there's too much work to do. And sometimes when we get into conversations with people, the thing that we would value most in that conversation, and this is a really sort of reflective sensing thing, is asking ourselves, what is it we're trying to achieve here? Sometimes the thing that as clinicians that we would most value is not being the person who has to take this patient. And that happens. And that's deeply uncomfortable. I have watched, and completely understandable simultaneously, I have watched so many discussions between clinicians where they are having an argument about a patient. I cannot remember ever watching clinicians having an argument about a patient when they both wanted to take the patient. They're both trying to get somebody else to take the patient. Yeah. And that's wrong. The system shouldn't be like that.
Yeah, because you forget that ultimately we're kind of concerned on that, and you know, the patient is our ultimate outcome, isn't it? Sort of improving patient care, but often all the other bits sort of get in the way. And I guess we've sort of focused quite a lot on how you know, incivility can affect us as you know, as clinicians in interpersonal relationships and things, but it can also have a huge knock on patient care, as you're saying.
Yeah, it knocks on to patient care in lots of different ways. One of the very first pieces of evidence I ever saw about this was actually from banking. It wasn't from healthcare, but there are some similarities. You really want to trust the organization that you put your money into, and you want to trust the organization that's looking after you or your loved one's health. And it turns out that when people go to a bank, about 80% of them, 80% of them, are net promoters of the bank. They really believe in the bank and they trust the bank. On seeing a single negative staff-on-staff interaction, that 80% reduces to 20%. And it doesn't matter if that negative staff-on-staff interaction is perceived as being legitimate. It's just seeing it reduces our likelihood of trusting and promoting that organization.
So you don't even have to be part of the interaction. That's just witnessing one.
Just witnessing. There's lots of evidence on the impact of people who witness incivility. Uh-huh. And, you know, in healthcare, just witnessing incivility on average leads to about a 20% reduction in people's cognitive ability. And I mean, if the mechanism through which this happens is probably that we perceive incivility. And remember, this may not have been the intent of the person who's talking. That's really important and quite difficult, that the person who's talking may not have been trying to be disrespectful or uncivil. But if we perceive that's what they were trying to be to somebody else, or that they just were disrespectful or uncivil, what happens is it triggers our threat center, and that diverts our cognitive resource away from being able to think creatively, positively, come up with great solutions, and instead starts the very beginnings of a fight or flight reaction. We don't feel it as that fight or flight reaction. We just feel a bit uncomfortable. Yeah. That's it. There's not.
I guess we feel we might be the next one to be shouted at or disrespected, well, potentially, isn't it?
And that's a real risk. Yeah. And you know, what happens is that people's performance then drops off. And as I said, 20% reduction in your cognitive ability. What's interesting about that is it's not evenly distributed through, well, interesting to me, it's not evenly distributed through everybody. A guy called Gaddy Gillam looked at this. And if you look at where people sit on the empathy spectrum, so there are people who are extremely empathic, those warm, lovely people, and there are people who are cold fish. And if you're a witness of this and you are at the cold fish end of the empathy spectrum, then you are significantly less impacted by seeing incivility or disrespectful behaviors between others. If, however, you're at the warm, empathic end, then that has more of an impact on you. And that's, you know, it's almost exactly what you'd expect to happen, But what's important is who do we want in healthcare? We want warm, empathic people, particularly in nursing. And if we're creating cultures where people are treating each other negatively, and that's being witnessed, then the people who are warmer are having more of a negative impact on their performance. So this is a
loose. And then you have the rate of attrition, don't you, as these people gradually get disillusioned and potentially leave services, isn't it? Which is obviously the opposite of what you want, isn't it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned before, if we take it back to the case that you and Joe, you know, were discussing about the operation and the consultant starting to lay into the registrar. I mean, hierarchies play, you know, within the NHS hierarchies. I remember as an F1, you know, you're fearful of your consultant. It's often the general surgeons, and obviously other specialties are available.
Yes.
Apologies to any surgeons listening, but everyone will have experienced, either as a student or as a doctor or an allied healthcare professional, you know, someone who's high up in an organization who it's clear they're the boss. And hierarchies can be a real challenge, you know, particularly. You know, there's many well-documented cases where things have gone wrong because of hierarchies and people being worried about speaking out and things. And I guess, you know, new F1s have just started, a month or so ago. So it's a really kind of valid topic, but it can be really challenging to speak out because of the potential implications that might have on you as a junior doctor, or, you know, getting your portfolio and all these other things. But then you're balancing that against, you know, wanting to do the right thing.
Yeah. And it's phenomenally difficult. So there's 30 years of research on this, in fact, more than that, about 35 years of research on this now, about how people might speak up in that setting. And it's actually nursing research. How might junior nurses speak up when they are confronted by a set of behaviours which feel disrespectful? And 30 years of research says that pretty much nothing works. It's extremely difficult to learn to speak truth to power. I think we look at this the wrong way. I think we should be talking to the people who are getting into positions of leadership, of authority. And we should be talking to them about how do they present themselves. Because pretty much everybody in a position of authority wants to make the best decisions. However, if they are in a position, if they present themselves as somebody who is unapproachable, then what happens is that people don't share information with them. And I think if we were to start to talk to people in leadership positions, say the quality of your decision is fundamentally impacted by the information that you have to hand, and you can't see it from all the different perspectives, you have to get people to give you information, and your behavior is stopping people speaking to you, then that gives those of us in positions of authority the opportunity to stop, reflect, and decide how we want to be. Decide what our theme tune should be when we walk in the door. You know, what do you want people to hear when you walk in the door? Do you want them to hear the theme tune to Jaws? Or do you want the people in the room to hear something positive and upbeat and be glad that you're walking in the room? And then make people want to share information with you so that you then get that information, because information in messy situations is the key driver of good decision making. We have to have technical knowledge as well, but if you don't know something, you simply cannot take it into account when you're making a decision. And that's all about leadership behaviors. That's about senior behaviors.
That's really interesting, isn't it? I think I really like the idea of what's your theme tune? I'll have to have a think about what mine is. I'm not sure. But I think the really interesting thing is, I mean, sometimes that approach, do you think it's that people don't want to necessarily show their vulnerabilities, you know, in a position of leadership? Because I suppose there's also that danger of, you kind of want to flatten your hierarchy a bit so that people feel sort of enabled to speak up. But you still want to kind of have some element of control. And I guess a lot of this is, as you say, it's kind of trying to teach people. I know you said you can't exactly teach them, but sort of discussing all these ideas with them at least. But there is that element of, well, I don't want to expose myself as a leader as potentially not knowing everything.
Yeah, that kind of, That's the absolute truth. Yeah, I mean, we have imposter syndrome when we get into leadership positions. Pretty much everybody does. You get into leadership position and you think, "Holy crap, how did I get here?" And oh my goodness, am I meant to know the answer to everything? And we drift into what Amy Edmondson would call image management. So we try and present ourselves in a way that makes other people have faith in us. The problem with that is it tends to lead us into a bit more command and control when we think that we're meant to know the answer to everything. And the truth is that our decision-making in these leadership roles is, as I've said already, it's dependent upon the information that we have. And if you think about it, you know, if you're the chief exec of an organization and you're cleverer than everybody else in the board about every job that they do, you've probably got the wrong board around you. You've probably got the wrong people around you because you would want them to know more about their thing than you do. You know, if I know more about surgery than the surgical registrar when I'm standing in recess and we're running trauma, well, there's something wrong there because, you know, the surgical reg should know more than me about that because that's their specialty and they're years down that. And for me, this becomes about what do we decide we want to be when we're in those groups? How do we want to present ourselves so that other people can feel that they're able to contribute? And I mean, there's loads of ways around this. One of them is to be quite explicitly welcoming of other people's opinions. And you can say to people, I mean, one of the things I say at the beginning of trauma, and I learned this from Magnus Harrison, who is, he will be in a couple of weeks' time, he'll be the medical director across the Leeds Trusts. But Mag was my consultant when I was a higher specialist trainee, and when he was running trauma, the last thing he said before patients came in was, "Okay, if you think I've missed something or you think I've got something wrong, please tell me. Because I might have missed something and I might have got something wrong. If you don't tell me, I won't know. If you tell me, I won't give you a hard time. I just need to know. We are each other's checks and balances." And what he was doing was explicitly giving permission to the team to talk. And he wrapped it up with a degree of assurance to them that they're not going to get a hard time for doing this, but also that it is their responsibility to do it. So that at the end of something that happens, that people can't turn around and go, "Well, I knew you were cutting off the wrong leg, but I decided to not say anything because you're scary." He's opened the door to that. And
that's such a powerful thing to do, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I think, and you know, things like the well-documented case with Elaine Bromley and things like that, people feeling that they know the right thing, but that it's that expert halo effect potentially, isn't it? You think, well, that person probably knows more than me and I'll just look stupid if I open my mouth. And the last thing you want to do at work or in any of these situations is look like an idiot. But I think, enabling people to actually speak up. And then I suppose a lot of it is how that person in authority reacts as well.
Yes.
And that's a very good question, but I've thought about X, Y, Z and it's not that because of this, this and this, rather than like, don't be so stupid.
Absolutely that. We are, you know, we're image managing. We're wrapped up in knowing stuff and not looking stupid. Doctors, nurses, healthcare staff, HPs, we don't want to look stupid. And the people who are in positions of authority are in a position to not let people feel stupid when they ask a question. Authority, there's a quote from a woman called Gillian Horton. And Gillian Horton's a doctor in Canada. And she said, "People with power have a duty to speak with care because they have been entrusted with something fragile that they have no right to break. And that is other people." People in position of power have been entrusted with this idea entrusted with the care of the folk that work for them. It's a form of servant leadership. And that is a burden. It's not something that you have the right to just use to destroy people. It's It's the responsibility to nurture people and to help them become better versions of themselves and to learn things and not to shut them down. And that, you know, it's quite a difficult thing to do sometimes. You know, when we're under a ton of pressure, if I've got a million things going on and somebody comes up and talks to me and I think, oh my God, you're a complete Muppet. And yeah, I'm tempted to say something along those lines because my filter goes when there's too much stuff going on. And then remembering, you know, what I'm about to say is going to have a massive impact on that person's day. And choosing words that support people, enlighten them, and don't diminish them is part of what I would see as responsibility of leadership. Sometimes, though, we get it wrong, and everybody gets it wrong.
Yeah, definitely. I think, we can all sort of probably empathize with those kind of situations. But I think a lot of the time, as you say, it's about nurturing. Obviously, yeah, it's balancing your own self-image, but also nurturing other individuals with less experience so that they can be the best version of themselves, like you were saying. I think that's, and then you keep people in your team and you keep people in your organization because they feel valued, don't they? I think that's, we could open a whole can of worms about value of workforce within the NHS. That's probably a discussion for another time. But it is important, isn't it? Particularly in newly formed teams, which we often get, you know, when it's the crash team or the trauma team coming together. Super important, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it's interesting that those newly formed teams are sometimes called action teams. People who come together, have a task, and then fall apart again afterwards. I mean, the way we do this in the NHS is it's a function of how busy everybody is, that it just finishes and we all disappear in different directions. But it's categorically an awful way to run those kinds of teams, because what you'd really want to do is you would want those teams to come together. You'd actually want them to meet at the beginning of the day at some point to know they're all on the crash team. And then you would want them to be doing introductions so that you vaguely knew who was going to turn up, crash team, trauma team, whatever. And then after they had been to the crash or the trauma or whatever, we would do an after-action review. We would discuss what happened, taking into account two specific things. The first is the emotions of the people involved, because for some people, that's the most important thing. But also the second part is the technical aspects of the quality of care that we gave, so that people were able to understand the decisions that were made and why they were made. Instead, we don't do that. We tend to have a sort of crash and then people drift off as other people arrive. And it is an absolutely brilliant way to not get the learning from these incidents. And I have colleagues who get really frustrated that some other colleagues do debriefs after significant things that happen, because the colleagues who are getting frustrated are seeing the queue of patients. Come on, guys, we need to get out there and we need to be looking after these patients. But the truth is, we don't get the learning if we don't have those conversations, and they become really important. And one of the things you did mention, that valuing workforce is a whole other conversation, but there's just one thing on that I'd really like to pick up. And it's this, that one of the most powerful ways that we can value other people is by acknowledging their presence. When we ignore people, it feels to them like they have no value. And if we think about some words that we use, like please, thank you, and sorry. Please, thank you, and sorry. You might think they're all doing something different, but on one level, they're all doing the same thing. All those words are acknowledging the existence of another person. You know, when you walk through, this must have happened to you. You've walked along and you've held a door open for somebody. And they've just waltzed through.
Yeah.
And you think, stuff you. In fact, that's not really what I think. I think much more crude Scottish ways of thinking these things in my head. And I think, really, really? I just held the door open. And I've walked along with people in positions of authority who have literally either walked along a corridor with people opening doors, they've not said thank you once, or they've done something different, which is they've walked along and they've opened every door for themselves, but they've never once looked behind them to see if somebody was behind them, because they're so wrapped up in whatever's going on in the world. And if we want to value people, just noticing them makes them feel more valued. Pretty much everybody who's listened to this will know that if you know the cleaners' names, or even if you don't know them, if you just say thank you to them and see them, that actually pays huge dividends. That means that those guys feel that they've been seen. And people want to be seen. There's an expression, I heard it used years ago, and I never really got it, it's I see you. And and basically what it means is, you know, you exist.
That's so powerful, isn't it? I think if you exist and feel valued, then you feel more fulfilled and everything is obviously much better than sort of just being a statistic or an invisible person, because then you feel that, well, what's the point in doing anything at all?
Yeah, exactly that. I have a friend, Neil Spensley. He's a clinical director in paediatric intensive care medicine in Glasgow. And Neil occasionally has done shifts as a cleaner in his department. Now, Neil's a big lump. He'd be, you know, well over 6 foot. He's a big, baldy Highlander bloke. And when he dons the cleaner's uniform, people that he knows, that he's worked with for years, walk right past him. He becomes invisible to them because he's got that uniform on. And I think that's a sort of a fairly stark illustration of what happens to us. And taking the time, and the more senior you get, the more powerful you are around this stuff. When you're senior and you turn around and you acknowledge the presence of people who are on the hierarchy significantly less than you, and we're all equal in the eyes of whatever god you have, but in the workplace we're not all equal. When we acknowledge other people, we have such a powerful impact on their day, and that really, I think it's just a really incredibly useful thing. It's really powerful. It makes their day better. It makes my day better. It makes it easier for me to get stuff done. There are a whole bunch of things in my organization I have no idea whatsoever about how they get done. But if I go to Ray, who's my friend who I've worked with for years, who's one of the porters, if I say, Ray, can this happen? Ray just makes it happen. Now, if I didn't know Ray's name, I'm not sure Ray would just make that happen. He might. But we have a relationship that's built on mutual respect, and we got there through knowing each other's names and using names. And, you know, that doesn't happen overnight, but knowing people's names, introduction.
That's really interesting what you're saying about names and first names. And what are your thoughts on, because different people will have, you know, they have different views on whether such and such persons could be doctor this, doctor that, or, you know, matron this, or whatever your title is, or whether they should just be Chris or Daniel, or what do you think?
Okay, so I am a squat, beardy, middle-aged, white guy with a beard. When I walk in the room, it doesn't matter what I call myself. I've got a stethoscope around my neck. Everybody thinks I'm the consultant, and I am. So I'm quite happy to be called Chris. That's absolutely fine with me. I'm also happy to be called Dr. Turner or Dr. Chris if people want to do that. I don't think it's appropriate for me to say to somebody who may be a young-looking 23-year-old, F1, maybe a woman, who's just started working, who's feeling a wee bit unsure of themselves, as we all are inside anyway, I don't think it's appropriate for me to say that they should be known by their first name. I think that is a personal choice. And I certainly think that it's unfair on patients that somebody would walk in the room and they wouldn't know what the role of that person was. So for me, I think titles are very important. I don't think your title makes you better, worse, or anything else compared to anybody else. But I think patients need to know who they're dealing with. And for a patient to go through a whole interaction with a member of staff and then who might be the F2 or whatever, and then to ask, when is the doctor coming, is actually a really difficult situation. So it's a wee bit like there's an awful lot of people my kind of level who will talk about how you hold a conversation with a consultant about something. And what they completely forget is that wasn't how they could do it when they were a house officer in an F1 or an F2, because the authority gradient had a huge impact. And I think we have to listen to people who are in those positions to understand what they want and how they want to be called. And in terms of how they have interactions with people senior to them, we need to think about what works for them, not what works for me. Because, you know, I'm powerful. I know that. In my
it's
little
true.
World,
it's true. It is, yeah.
I am powerful.
Yeah.
So in my take on names, you know what? Let people choose for themselves. But whatever we choose for them to have, or they choose for themselves to have it in a name badge that's bloody big. Don't have their name badge so small that you can't see it. And put it somewhere where patients can see it. I have a pet hate, which is people who hang their name badge off their trouser pocket and then have a top that hangs down over it. So firstly, to find out what their name is, I have to be glancing down at their genitals, basically. And I don't want to be spending my day doing that. And I know patients don't want to be doing that. And the second thing is quite often their shirts will be over the top of it. So let's think about where we put our badges so that people can see what the badge says, so that we can give people the respect that using their name gives them. You've poked me on something that's actually I'm quite passionate about here. And I think that knowing people's names, you know, I think we should be introducing ourselves by our names, but you get to choose what your name is. You get to choose if you use a salutation or not. That's absolutely fine. The important thing is that patients should know, and your colleagues should know as well.
It's really interesting. You touched on the. There's so many different things. I knew we'd discuss lots about authority gradients and things like that. I don't know if you do you know the book Games People Play.
Yes, from a long time ago. Yeah,
I think I got advised to read it as part of my GP training, and it's heavy going. You know, I didn't read all of it. I'll be honest about that. But it is really interesting to think about the different child on child or adult, and the different gradients, and you know, and similar when we're interacting with patients, are we interacting on an equal level, or actually, where are we in that? It's fascinating, isn't it?
It is completely fascinating, and it's there are so many different models of all this stuff. I think one of the easiest ways for me to think about it is Don Berrick talks about era one, era two, and era three medicine. And in era one medicine, and I am old enough to have come from era one medicine. In era one medicine, the doctor was the authority figure, and we said, and patients did. At least that was what we thought was going on, because of course patients weren't doing, but we said and they did. And then we got into era two medicine. Era two medicine was a bit more jumbled, and we're kind of still in it just now. An awful lot of management, a lot of metrics, a lot of people being driven to get more productivity out of them. And then there's era three medicine. And era three medicine is where doctors, and this is a very GP model anyway, but I think it applies to those of us in secondary care as well, where doctors and patients are in partnership in an understanding of what the issues that are important to the patient are, the issues that, as we see it, as doctors are, as healthcare professionals, and coming to a collective decision about what the right thing to do for this individual in this situation at this moment in time is. And that's been a sort of long journey for me, because I was kind of dyed-in-the-wool, evidence-based medicine kind of guy. Mm. If the evidence said this is what you need, then that's what I'd be telling you we should be doing. And just gradually over the years, that the value that I have for evidence-based medicine it's not been eroded. I still think evidence-based medicine is a brilliant thing, but it has been matched by my respect for what patients want, what they value, and the recognition that the only way I know what patients want and what patients value is to get into a curious conversation with them, to get into a conversation where I open the door to them telling me what's going on for them and what they value. And that takes time. It takes time, and it means that I have to create the right sort of environment. And if you go into a room, and it doesn't matter if you're talking to a colleague or a patient, if you go into a room and you don't leave somebody feeling respected, they don't share with you particularly. If I go into a room and I start an interaction with a patient by introducing myself, using my name, using their name, finding out if they're in pain, that sort of stuff at the beginning, and then asking them what's going on, giving them space to talk, and then sometimes getting into what's important for them. And if I do that, then I get to much better decisions. And it's basically, to use technical jargon about this, it's moving from being a deontologist, which is somebody who believes you just follow the rules and that's you get the right result by following the rules, to practicing with phrenesis, which is phrenesis. And phrenesis is this concept of a practically wise situated decision. What's the right thing for this patient right here, right now, taking into account what I know, what they know, what we've exchanged, so that we come up with the best thing for them, not the best thing for me, but the best thing for them at the end of that, sharing what knowledge I have. And, you know, that's taken, that's a career right there, isn't it? You know, sort of moving through different modes and different ways of thinking about how we interact with other people so that we get to the best decisions. And the same thing applies to my interactions with my professional colleagues. So, you know, if we've got a group of people standing around, it's not about why I'm right. And we talked about this at the very beginning.
Yeah,
it's about how do we share information? So not to be right, but to do the right thing.
That's it, isn't it? I think that summarizes it really, really well, actually. And yeah, you mentioned it's a bit of a GP thing. Yeah, we get it drummed into us during our training. But I think it is true, isn't it? Unless you're sort of sharing the patient or your colleague's paradigm, then how are you going to understand things? How are you going to make progress? And that's a super valuable lesson to take forward. I'm just conscious that we've chatted about a whole bunch of things. It's been really fascinating. I just wondered, I mean, a lot of these things are all kind of transferable, aren't they, to sort of all walks of life, but are there any particular kind of key messages that you think would translate particularly well for sort of the expedition and wilderness medicine setting? Because obviously you've got a whole bunch of different challenges there.
Yes. Okay. So the starting point is how we treat each other matters. You know, behavior matters. It matters in a demonstrable, measurable way. And when we treat people well and they feel treated well, then they share more information and they perform at a higher level. When we're under pressure, that, and I'm talking here about when we maybe aren't able to think so straight because maybe you've been out for a long time, maybe you're high up. Maybe it's a really stressful situation. But when we're under pressure, we tend to default to command and control ways of behaving. But unless it is something incredibly immediate, we almost always do better when we move from command and control to a shared understanding model. And the big thing for me that helps me to do that is when I get into conversations with people, even if I don't particularly like them, and that's going to happen to all of us, is getting into that conversation with curiosity, not judgment. Because if I don't like somebody and they start saying something, I tend to think, oh, what's this arsehole saying now?
Yeah.
Well, that's no way to think about what they're telling me. Because what I want is I want that information. And taking myself away from a judgment-based perspective on people to one of curiosity allows me, and I consciously do this now, it allows me to get the information from them which we are going to use to make the best decision with. And that's difficult. That there's nothing simple about taking yourself away from the decision that, you know, you don't like somebody and therefore they're a bad object. We need to remember that everybody's trying to do the right thing just through very different lenses sometimes. So getting into a position where I am all about curiosity, all about trying to understand, not understanding going, but the however, shouldn't be just shutting up, listening to people's perspectives, understanding it, taking it into account, and adding it to the sum of knowledge I will use to try to make the best decision that I can. And that for me is probably the big take home, taking behavior matters, but share information and take curiosity, not judgment, into these interactions.
Yeah, that's fantastic advice, Chris. And I've got one last question for you, and you don't have to answer it, but what is your theme tune?
Oh, do you know?
I put you on the spot.
No. There's a song by Right Said Fred, and see, I really struggle with this because Right Said Fred have turned out to be anti-vaxxers and COVID denier dudes, and yet they have a song called Deeply Dippy, and there's this glorious bit in Deeply Dippy where it comes along and it's just quite calm, it's quite calm, and then it explodes into high camp happiness. Stays there for a little bit, and then it stays there for a bit longer, and then it goes back to itself. And I really like it. I would like it if people heard that when I came in the room, that if they thought when I came in the room that I'm going to be supportive, that I'm going to be interested, and that I perhaps might bring a little bit of joy to their day, but no anti-vaxxer stuff.
Oh, that's fantastic. I must say I don't know, but I will have to check it out for sure. And I'll put a link in there to a video or the track on the description of the podcast, because I think we need to hear that now. It's been really great chatting with you. Thank you so much for giving up your time. I've learned a lot. I think it's been really interesting, and I know we've only scratched the surface of quite a complicated topic, but I hope people listening have got a lot out of it in the same sort of way. I've really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you, Daniel. It's been a complete pleasure. I'm really glad we managed to do it after a couple of false starts on our part. Thank you so much. It's been a delight.
If you've enjoyed listening to our podcast, then check out our website, www.thewildernessmedic.com. If you're interested in being a guest on a future episode or writing a blog for us, then do get in touch, and don't forget to follow us on social media. Until next time, take care.